For the week of September 23rd, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 425, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. We're off to the races. We're going to get this done in under an hour because Sperling is getting ready to go away on a trip.
That's right. I am going to the Geneva Convention where I will be moderating a panel on, guess what, Michael?
Human rights?
No, that actually would be, I'd feel, somewhat like a UN representative. No, on subscription movie going, our favorite topic here. I guess talking about MoviePass enough has gotten people to go, hey, that guy must be an expert. He should moderate a panel on it. And I will be in Wisconsin at the Geneva Convention at Lake Geneva moderating a panel. So if you're there, please stop by, say hello.
Wow, that's awesome. I wish you would live stream it or we'd be able to see it online somehow, even in the future, if not when it was happening.
Well, actually, I don't know why I didn't think of doing that. I should try and figure out how to do that.
Yes, you should, because there won't be a show next week. Isn't that right?
That's probably right, because I will be headed off to Brazil, actually, to go to another convention, another conference. Although I thought I was leaving on Sunday, I might be leaving on Monday, which might leave room for a show. Hold your horses. So maybe we can squeeze another one in.
All right, so some quick stuff. First of all, A Star is Born, the 1976 version. Last week, I accurately said it was a critical bomb and a commercial hit, but I wasn't sure about the Oscars. In fact, it was nominated for 4 Oscars, and it won Best Song for the tune Evergreen, which was one of Barbara Streisand's biggest hits in her entire career, number one for 3 weeks. So that's pretty cool. I just wanted to clarify that. We weren't exactly wrong last week, but nominated for 4 Oscars is a lot different from, I'm not even sure if it was up for one.
Wait, isn't that the song Love, Soft as an Easy Chair?
That's right.
Yeah. The funny thing is, who wrote that song? Wasn't it Paul Williams?
It was co-written by Barbara Streisand and Paul Williams.
Well, it's funny because that will come back later in the show. Paul Williams will come up later in the show.
Oh, I didn't even know that. Well, I do know that Maroon 5 will be coming back to the Super Bowl. They're going to be the halftime show. That's always big news. But when you look at their career, because of the way album sales have gone, they had a massive debut, and then they sort of dropped and dropped and dropped. It looks like a career that's sort of in decline. But in fact, if you look at their singles, they got a lot of hit singles with a lot of collaborations. They've had songs with Kendrick Lamar and Cardi B and Christina Aguilera. So there could be a lot of guest stars when Maroon 5 hosts the Super Bowl halftime show. But what I really wish is that when we're looking at this act and trying to determine how big they are, we could look at like a streaming chart that talks about the biggest streaming acts of the week and the month and the year and stuff like that, because that's what matters now, not album sales. And singles are a little misleading as well, so that's a bummer.
I need a little audio effect or a bell so that every time you kind of mentioned, how Billboard's charts are all honked up, that I can, ring the little bell.
Well, speaking of audio clips and charts and dings and things, New York Times Magazine. Have you read their magazine this week?
No, although I did get the paper this morning at the end of my driveway, and I always love the Sunday newspaper. I ripped it open, and there's like a big design and lifestyle magazine that's in it right now. And of course, there's the New York Times Magazine, a great weekly magazine. I don't know how they put it together. It's great every week, but it's a special issue. It's like a different kind of... I thought, I don't have time to go through this right now. We're recording today.
Well, they do it every week with just scrap and vim and vigor and, multimillion-dollar budgets and thousands of people on staff. So somehow they manage to get through it every week. But yes, it's a special issue. It's their Voyages issue where they sort of have a travel issue. And this year, it's almost all photographs and no text. But there is a podcast, an audio portion to it that you're supposed to listen to while you look at the photos. And they treat this like it's the second coming. They're like, we're going to have pictures and sound. And you're like, people have been doing that. Yes, but they're pictures with sound of the thing that you're looking at. So they think it's just this revelatory thing. There's a lava volcano in Hawaii. There's the lava and you can hear the sound of the lava. And you're like, nature documentaries kind of do that. Putting all it aside, the photos are cool. The audio stuff is interesting about the sound of rats communicating in the subways of New York and the sound of the desert in Chile at night. It's interesting stuff. Frankly, you don't need the photos. In fact, I think it works better with your imagination just listening to the podcast, if I can call it that. Frankly, what they did was they created a radio play. a radio show where you use your imagination and they say, here's the sound of a volcano and lava. And you go, oh, that's cool. And they tell the story with the audio. You really don't need to look at the pictures. In fact, sometimes there are like four pictures and they don't even let you know you should be turning the pages. You know, there's no beep or anything. So with the first one, they got to the end of the section and moved on to the next one. I hadn't even realized I was supposed to turn the page. So, you know, a fine effort, but people, it's called radio. Don't get that excited. But we've got a podcast for you. And what's going to be on it this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we put on our headphones and rock out to all the news being made in the music industry. Last week, the EU took a major step towards overhauling copyright. And this week, the US Senate passed the landmark Music Modernization Act. We'll look at what that means. Meanwhile, Spotify made it easier than ever for independent artists to upload their music directly to the streaming service, but they're not competing with the record labels. Yeah. Right. And music revenue figures are out for the first half of 2018, and streaming keeps gaining ground. In China news, the cleanup of tax dodgers is still making headlines around the world, but the next area of corruption getting a look-see may be TV ratings. In book filter news, Michael will offer up a project centered around abstract painters that is perfect for this Me Too era and includes five juicy roles for actresses. In sexual misconduct news, editor, Ian Baruma?
Yes, Baruma.
Baruma, yeah. He is out at the New York Review of Books. Depending on your point of view, he's out for trying to engage in a dialogue and hear all sides, or he's out for being utterly clueless. By the way, there are no points for guessing which side Michael takes in that argument. On Inside Baseball, we've got even more news from music. A Canadian investigation by the media CBC detailed more than ever the shenanigans taking place when concert tickets go on sale. It's a PR nightmare for Ticketmaster unless state officials get involved, in which case it might lead to real change. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. I love it when Sperling has to wing it because he's rushing and he doesn't have time to look at the show notes thoroughly. It's exciting. It's live. It's theater. It's radio. It's very exciting, but we're going to keep moving.
You know what? I think we should probably make a big deal out of it. Maybe publish a magazine with pictures. And then, you know, we'll put in the beeps, though.
Anyway, we have links to ComScore in our show notes because we're looking at box office around the world, and that's what ComScore does. We also pull information from Variety and Hollywood Reporter, the Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, the New York Times, the LA Times. You are listeners, and the number one movie around the world is The Nun. The latest film in the Conjuring franchise is still going very, very strong, $45 million on the weekend, $290 million worldwide. It's going to blow past the original Conjuring, which is still the top grossing one in that franchise. That's at $318 million. So they're clearly going to blow past that. And this will be the biggest horror flick in the Conjuring franchise history. And they're just going to keep on coming. At number two is another movie that wants to scare you, but it's more family friendly, even though it's directed by Eli Roth. It's The House with a Clock in Its Walls, a classic children's book. I'm interested to know what they did with this. It stars Cate Blanchett and Jack Black, or as some people would say, Jack Black and Cate Blanchett. But you know what? She's in a lot of more big movies than Jack Black, so I think her name should come first.
What about alphabetically?
There you go. That would be Jack, wouldn't it?
Yes.
But that's not the way it works. But this movie made $30 million on its opening weekend. It opened in 15 territories. It cost about $40 million to make, so they're in good territory. At number three is The Predator, the latest in that franchise, $25 million on the weekend. That's just about to pass the $100 million mark. That has a ways to go to become the highest grossing in the franchise and even farther to go to become profitable at the box office alone. At number four is a Hong Kong action film. It's Golden Job. It made $23 million on the weekend, and it's about, I think their triad members are gangsters or shady people of sort, but they're the good guys, and they're trying to steal back some gold from some other bad guys, or something's going on. At least that's what I could figure out from the trailer. But it's basically an unofficial reunion of the stars from an iconic 90s film series called Young and Dangerous. That movie, I think, had like six of them, five or six at least, and that sort of made the triads look super sexy and romantic and fun, which I'm not really down with normally, but they were good action films, and the trailer to Golden Job looked kind of fun as well. And again, that's at $23 million on its opening weekend, and so it's off to a very good start. And number five is Johnny English Strikes Again, the Rowan Atkinson film. That opened in more territories, and now it's got some good news. Maybe it opened up in a really small territory last week. It would be awesome if there was a chart where we could see exactly what territories movies had opened up in and what were left. But anyway, Johnny English has now made $17 million this weekend. It's at $22 million worldwide. The reviews remain quite poor, so it's going to struggle to match the $160 million of the first two, but we'll have to see where it ends up. That's why you wait. At number six is a film Sperling liked. It's A Simple Favor, $15 million on the weekend, $42 million worldwide. And Sperling is joined by our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, who also said, hey, I really liked that movie.
You know, it's one of those movies that you go and you think, all right, fine, I'll see the movie, whatever. I happened to see it at Cine Europe. And I thought, okay, this is the movie they're screening on the last day. Fine, Paul Feig is here, and he's always he's always dapper. He's always dressed really to the nines. And I thought, fine, I'll go see it. And then you leave, and you're like, wow, that was way better than I thought it was going to be. And it's actually a lot of fun. It's actually really good.
Well, I'll have to check it out, and maybe I'll do it if I could get a movie subscription service that actually I could afford and would let me see movies in any theater. If only there was an option.
I think Cinemia is an option. Right?
That's right. You've been pointing out the news there, but you'll have more information after your convention in Geneva.
Correct.
At number seven is Crazy Rich Asians, another $11 million on the weekend. That has passed the $200 million mark worldwide. When they made this movie for $30 million and Warner Brothers was behind it, I thought, you know, they're smart because they can expect to make a lot more money than usual in Asian territories, because it's a film with Asian stars and with that setting. And the funny thing is, that's actually not where they're raking in the bucks. Most of their money has been made in North America, $160 million in North America. They may not even get released in China, the second biggest market in the world. So that tells you how diverse North American audiences are. And when you make a good movie, you can reach a big audience and you don't need those other territories. But that really is not what I expected when this movie was happening. And number eight is Mission Impossible Fallout. That's a movie you do expect to make a lot of money worldwide. $9 million on the weekend. That's at a funny little $777 million worldwide. That's a fun number.
So it's not 007, it's 777.
That's right. We'll show you James Bond. And number nine is L Storm. $9 million on the weekend. $55 million worldwide for the Hong Kong thriller. And if you can explain to us how the series went from Z-Storm to S-Storm to L-Storm, for the love of God, contact us and let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can call, I already said the call, but you can follow us on Twitter. @ShowbizSandbox is our handle. That's @ShowbizSandbox. Or you can follow us on Facebook or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox.
I think we should call this podcast the latest podcast, flaws and all. Anyway, at number 10 is The Great Battle. This is a Korean period drama. It's about a famous story, an epic battle in the 600s, the siege of Anxi City. It's sort of their Stalingrad in that country's collective memory. It was a siege that lasted 88 days as they held out against a 500,000 strong army from China. It was the Tang Dynasty, I think. This movie made $9 million on the weekend, and it's one of three or four big movies that opened up in Korea. It was a big weekend at the box office in Korea. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe there's some holiday I'm not aware of. Again, Sperling just gave you the info. Let us know if there was. But two of the other movies that opened up did less well, but you know, they've still got a ways to go. One was Feng Shui, a period drama about the struggle to be king. $4.6 million on the weekend. And right below that was a movie I'm sort of interested in seeing. It's The Negotiation, a crime thriller set in the present, and it's about Korean hostages held in Bangkok. And the negotiator who steps in to do it is a woman. That doesn't happen a lot in crime thrillers in Korea, so that's fun to see. And that stars Sun Yi-jin. So she's a big rising star. This movie made $4 million on its opening weekend, a little bit below Feng Shui, but they all cost, you know, those two cost $9 million to make, and The Great Battle cost $19 million to make, so we'll have to see where they all end up. Certainly the best reviewed of the bunch was The Great Battle. At number 11 is The Incredibles 2, another $8 million on the weekend. Right below that is Jia Chung Kyu, his film Ashes Purest White, $5.9 million on its opening weekend in China, even though they snipped out images of a famous director that he's friends with because that guy's now under a cloud from the government. Lots of stuff happening in China, and this movie was cut by 6 minutes, not just for commercial reasons, but also for political reasons.
It could have been cut by 60 minutes, and I'm not sure it would have been any worse off.
Oh, really? You didn't like the movie?
No.
Well, there you go. But he's certainly a terrific major director, and how he's had his career in China is quite the puzzle to me.
He is so, it's blatantly anti-China, not anti-Chinese, but he definitely makes a lot of social commentary in this film.
Right, perhaps he's anti-totalitarian or pro-democracy or free speech. That's not anti-Chinese, that's anti the current government.
Well, yeah, and it's not, you're right, and it's not, you know, anti-Chinese. It's more anti, there's certain social things that he takes on in this particular film that he always takes on, and he's kind of making a commentary on the way China is today socially.
Well, there's nothing more patriotic than dissent and holding up a mirror to your society and saying, we could be better.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. And number 13 is Searching, the John Cho film, $5 million on the weekend, which is just about the budget of the movie, but worldwide it has made $55 million. Scrolling down for something new, I think we already covered the Korean films. Here's a new movie on the charts. It's a documentary. Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 11/9 opened to what people would say was poorly in North America, $3.1 million on its opening weekend, including money from me. I saw it with my friend Noam. The movie was messy. I felt it was my civic duty to be there, however, and I kind of enjoyed it.
Talking about holding up a mirror to your own nation, that's pretty much what that movie's all about.
That's right. People, of course, immediately said, what a disaster this is. It's so low. It's terrible. Only $3 million on its opening weekend. That immediately places it number 75 on the list of the top grossing documentary films of all time in North America. In fact, five films on that chart right now are also pretty much in theaters right now. And they are the Fred Rogers documentary, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary, Three Identical Strangers, Dinesh D'Souza's agitprop Death of a Nation, and Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 11/9. If Fahrenheit 11/9 can double its opening weekend before all is said and done, it will just pass Death of a Nation. That's at $5.9 million. Again, no slouch for a documentary film. So this is really a golden era for documentary movies. Michael Moore, you know, he's a muckraker, better muckraker than movie maker. There was some stuff I enjoyed in the film, some stuff I took issue with, but overall, I found it interesting.
Well, speaking of mucking rake or raking muck, I know that you have a whole list of stuff from the Middle Kingdom. I love that we call it the Middle Kingdom, by the way.
Well, that's true.
And Fan Bingbing, we talked about last week that nobody's seen her. Okay, there was this whole, you know, issue that had she cheated her taxes, she had this dual contract where she was telling the government, oh, I'm so poor, they only paid me $1 to be in this movie, in this TV series, so you can't tax me.
And who's the biggest star in North America? Who's the biggest female star right now?
Right now? Yeah. What is it? Jennifer Lawrence, maybe, or...
Not Jennifer Lawrence, no. Maybe Jennifer Lawrence, yeah. So it's as if Jennifer Lawrence, I thought for some reason I heard Jennifer Lopez. It's as if she just disappeared. And in fact, one new detail we have is that CAA hasn't heard from Fan Bingbing since she disappeared in June. So it's June, July, August, and now the end of September. People assume she will be arrested, though some close to her say she hasn't been yet.
So maybe she's in hiding, actually.
Well, not from the government. That doesn't work too well in China. If she had left the country, that would be true. And I believe some people suggested maybe you should. But there you go. Anyway, that's still ongoing. I thought that info about CAA was interesting. The real fallout is that a lot of deals are going to need to be reworked.
Point out that CAA is her agent, and
right,
they will
course.
Be the ones doing the reworking.
Well, not her contracts, everybody's contracts.
Oh,
I don't mean,
yeah, that's
I don't
true.
Mean Fan Bingbing's contracts. I mean the contracts of all these deals for current and upcoming movies in China need to be reworked so that they can come in line with the law. You know, or not be seen as possibly skirting the law. So that's interesting. And of course, this is all why Crazy Rich Asians may not get a release in China. They are cracking down on conspicuous consumption. They've been having a trouble for a while with stars living a lavish life. And this is part of that.
Yeah, but the life that is depicted in Crazy Rich Asians is lavish for just humanity, really. It's lavish for humanity.
Right, exactly. It's insane, absurd, and over the top. That's part of the joke. But anyway, this is serious. There's a lot going on. And let's not forget, HBO disappeared when John Oliver mocked Xi. When he mocked the leader of China, the dictator, frankly now, HBO scrubbed from the airwaves, scrubbed from the internet. You cannot find anything about HBO or John Oliver anymore if you're in China. Christopher Robin, the Disney movie, didn't get released because some people used Winnie the Pooh to associate it with mocking Xi. And that meant Disney's Christopher Robin was no way going to get released in theaters because just going to the movie could be seen as a sign of protest.
And the irony is that if I recall correctly, John Oliver was saying, why is everybody so upset that Xi Jinping or, you know, that Winnie the Pooh is being associated with Xi Jinping or vice versa when everybody loves Winnie the Pooh? You know, he's a lovable bear.
He is indeed, but he was still making fun of the leader of China. And now that all this stuff is happening, it looks like the next area that the government is going to be cracking down on, and there is corruption, so it's not all for the bad. This is the corruption in TV world. There is a big shakedown going on in TV ratings. Sometimes you'll do a TV special or a show, and then the TV station that's going to air it says, hey, you want your show to have good ratings? Give us a couple bucks on the side. They literally shake down people so that they can goose the ratings for them artificially. So what's happened is that two people, I believe, the president and the CTO of China's iResearch company, sort of equivalent to Nielsen, sort of, they have disappeared. People at their company say, no, they are assisting, I'm putting that in quotes, investigators. And in fact, it doesn't look like they would be part of the corruption as such, but would have information the government wants. So in China, TV ratings are always taken with a grain of salt, and it looks like the government is cracking down in that area as well.
Well, that kind of wraps up our China news and brings us, since you're talking about television, let's stick with television for a second. Veronica Mars, okay?
Sweet.
Yes, she is coming back. The show is coming back, but to Hulu, by the way, to Hulu.
Well, they got the rights to the old episodes, and frankly, the first season is really the one good one. Part of the second season is good, too, but they've gotten all the old episodes, and they're going to do a new miniseries, basically. It's 8 new episodes telling one mystery facing the town that she lives in. She set up her own – she's out of high school, obviously, and set up her own detective agency, and what happened is that something's gone wrong with spring break. There's been a big crime wave, and there's a tension between the rich people of the town who just want to, you know, enjoy their there's time there and want spring break to end for good, let it go somewhere else, and the small business owners who actually depend on that influx of money. I saw that very same thing happen in South Florida, where spring break was basically driven away. It was a huge, huge moneymaker for many, many years. They took over the town for like 6 weeks because every college had a different spring break, and there was always a tension between people who benefited from that and people who couldn't be bothered. And, well, that's what's happening on Veronica Mars, but I'm excited. All the original people are involved. I hope Max Greenfield is in there as well because he played a cop on the show.
He had
the weirdest voice. The first time I heard him on Craig Ferguson, I was like, you mean that's not his real voice on Veronica? I mean, where did he come up with that weird voice? He sort of had this slur, hey, Veronica Mars. He had this totally strange way of talking. And I just assumed this odd actor I'd never seen before, I figured that was the way he talked. And yet it wasn't. So that has always amused and pleased me. So I'm hoping he'll be on Veronica Mars as well.
Well, I do know that one of the best commercials during the Emmys this year was the one for Hulu where all of the celebrities were saying, you know, never ever fly first class or never stay in a 5-star hotel or never sleep in a king-size bed, because all of these things would, of course, ruin you. You'd never be able to sleep in another bed again, because once you slept in a king-size bed, well, you know, everything would pale in comparison. Once you flew first class, economy just wouldn't be good enough. And it ends with some celebrity, and I can't recall the celebrities who were on the commercial, saying, and never, ever get Hulu.
Well, I didn't watch the ads, so it's good to know. It's an interesting one.
So I guess at least one person watched the ads.
Yeah. At least one person of those 10 million people, the record low numbers. So that's TV, but that does move us right into music, doesn't it? And there's a lot going on there.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I don't even know where to start. Why don't we start with the Music Modernization Act, which passed, I guess, both the, well, passed the Senate, okay? And there's kind of another bill in the House. There's a House version of this. But here's where Paul Williams comes into play. Paul Williams got some people who were trying to push this bill through the Senate. And Mitch McConnell said, look, if you can get the following items lined up, it can just sail through. You got to get a couple of sponsors. You got it. There were all of these things. But Paul Williams and Orrin Hatch, and what, you know, they basically Paul Williams brought them to the Senate.
Okay.
These people who were championing the bill, but it is,
oh, you mean the artists who went there and campaigned and met with senators and said, we want this.
Yeah. Yes,
ultimately
correct.
It was sponsored by virtually everyone in the Senate and passed through unanimously. There are significant differences between the Senate and the House. In the Senate version, they have created a blanket mechanical license. They've also allowed issues that come up before the courts to rotate among certain judges rather than being heard by the same two judges, which is how it works today. And it also ends a clause that gave sort of a free ride to Sirius XM, which fought that particular change tooth and nail. Otherwise, Sirius XM got pretty much everything they wanted. As Rolling Stone clarified it, the Senate version of the bill accomplishes a couple key goals. It makes sure songwriters and artists receive royalties on songs recorded before 1972. That was a big loophole and a big change. This new bill allocates royalties for music producers. That didn't happen before. And finally, it updates licensing and royalty rules for streaming services to pay rights holders in a more streamlined way. In short, music makers will get more money.
Now, Orrin Hatch was the sponsor they wound up with, okay? And you'd think, well, what the heck is Orrin Hatch doing? You know, a senator from Utah trying to
do it. Isn't he a songwriter?
There you go. He has a couple of songs. They're religious songs. And he saw, with the you know, adoption of streaming, he saw his royalty checks from ASCAP BMI, which is Paul Williams was, you know, heading up. He saw them drop as streaming was adopted. And he said, well, why is that? And he had
what the heck's going on?
He had to be told about the mechanical license that, yes, when your song sells, you get paid as a songwriter. But when your song streams, it's not selling. And guess what's not selling now? Music
that's not right.
Yes.
That's not right, said Orrin Hatch.
And so all of a sudden, he fixed that problem. So it just goes to show you, if you want something done, you know, make sure it affects the politicians that are you want to pass the bill.
Absolutely. So the House and the Senate version need to be, what's it called?
Well, they kind of go
reconciled. Reconciled. That's what it is. So they're going to go into committee. They need to be reconciled. It needs to pass again. But just like the EU had a big step forward, this is a big step forward for a long overdue change. It's certainly going to affect Spotify. And another big change that Spotify had this week was in how they made their platform easier to access for independent artists. So the question is Amazon a publisher because it allows self-published authors to put books for sale on its website? It is now a publisher with its own imprint. But did that earlier thing where they said, hey, if you want to, you can put your book up for sale. Did that make them a publisher? Music labels are going to keep asking that question about Spotify because they just made it a lot easier for indie artists to upload music. You used to need a distributor. Now you can do it directly. If anything, I think this change really hurts indie distributors a lot more than major labels. But nonetheless, convincing acts they should sign with a big label like Sony or Warner Brothers maybe just got a little bit harder. What exactly are they providing in exchange for a cut of the music?
Well, right. Okay. So what all these indie distributors did was, and I don't want to say all they did, but what they did was you would, as an artist, let's say you're an independent artist and, you know, you don't have a big record deal or, you know, you don't have major support.
Right. Spotify is not going to make deals with 10,000 different artists. So
correct.
They just deal with 5 indie labels and those guys make the deals. And so they only have to deal with one person who knows how things work and how to put stuff in the system and all that sort of stuff.
But right. you'd pay as an artist, you pay like those distributors $9 a month to kind of manage the whole thing.
Right. And now Spotify said, you know what? We can make it easier for people and they can do it directly.
Right. It will kill all of those like services out there that help
if they provided nothing extra, it will, and that will be fine. If they added value or did something or realized they need to add value, then maybe they'll start earning their money, and that will be good for everyone. However, record labels have to be saying, are you sure you're not a record label, Spotify? Because it's sure getting close to it, isn't it?
Well, look, when Amazon was just saying, look, you can put your book on the shelf here. Now, you know, you're still going to have to go out and sell it because we're not going to do that.
They got a cut of the sale.
They got a cut of the sale. Okay, fine. But they are a retail outlet. Okay. And essentially they were saying, we have unlimited shelf space. You want to put your book on the shelf? Fine. People still have to find it. They still have to search for it. They still have to buy it. You still have to get them to Amazon to purchase it. You know, we're not being discriminatory. Anybody can put their books here because, again, right, unlimited shelf. Same thing with Spotify, unlimited, you know, CD rack, so to speak. Anybody can put their music up. You still have to get people to stream it. You still have to get people to listen to it. And when they do, you will get paid. But we're not going to go out and seek out music. Yeah,
let's be sure about that, because let's make sure the algorithm doesn't favor people that, you know, work directly with them, because that would be sort of a telltale sign that the system is gamed for those people.
And I agree with you. I think time will tell. But I think part of their algorithms are, gee, you know, 10 million people are listening to this one song. Let's try and get more people to listen to it because it must be popular. And so we want to be, you know, when people show up, we want to make sure that they see, oh yeah, they do have, you know, Spotify does have that really popular song. Oh, you know, Havana, that I hear being sung everywhere.
Exactly. And Spotify just got bigger. They are launching probably in November in the Middle East and North Africa. So streaming continues to spread around the world. It's still not in every territory. And revenue for the music industry, after really hitting a low point, has been picking up steam. It's not where it was before, but it is getting stronger and stronger.
Well, in North America, streaming added 1 million subscribers a month over the past 6 months. 70,000 albums were released in the first half of 2018.
Including my cover of Stephen Sondheim. You know, Michael sings Sondheim. I hope you all listen to it.
I don't even want to know what that is. by the way, you can distribute that directly through Spotify if you'd like. Now, paid subscribers to streaming jumped from 31 million to 46 million in 6 months.
That's North America.
Yeah, just North America. Now, music revenue. In 2016 mid-year, we were at $3.5 billion. Okay. And then last year, we were at $4.2 billion. And this year, 2018, mid-year, first 6 months, $4.6 billion. So the trend is going in the right direction.
So when you look and you break down that music revenue, 75% of that revenue comes from streaming. Digital downloads are 12%. And physical product, that's CDs and vinyl, that's just 10%, with sync being another 3%. I guess it's like jukeboxes and things like that. I don't know.
No, sync is when you have, you're basically, you know, television commercials or, you know.
That's it?
Yes.
Only 3% of revenue comes from all that? Really?
Yes,
oh, that's
correct.
A surprise. I thought that would be more in publishing and another area of revenue. So CDs and vinyl are 10% of the total music revenue. Physical product, just 10%. CDs, however, fell 41%, and vinyl is up 13%. They're almost dead even. CDs grossed $250 million in the first 6 months. Vinyl, $200 million. So sometime soon, vinyl, or actually very soon, maybe by the end of the year, vinyl is going to be grossing more money than CDs.
You know,
that's
what?
How quickly that has faded away.
I'm going to go out and buy some CDs. I love CDs. I have tons of CDs, and I know that, you know, vinyl sometimes sounds better, but I'm going to make sure I buy CDs of the artists that I would normally buy CDs for.
And where would you go to do that? Because you're not going to find them at Target and Walmart anymore, if you even can today.
Well, I would go to either Amazon, or if I, in person, I would go to Amoeba Records.
All right. New York, I have very few choices left. There really aren't any. Not really. There's one row of used and new CD stuff, but that's about it, you know, down by the East Village. And that's just about it, really.
Well, when I was in New York during the summer, or maybe it was, you know, in 2017 in April, and I went past Discorama and saw that it was closed, I burst into tears. I couldn't believe it.
Well, I hope, you know, on your trip back, instead of listening to some music, you read a book.
Which book would I read? You know what? Actually, I picked up the Los Angeles Times today. And yes, I do get both the LA Times and the New York Times on Sunday. And sure enough, there on the business section was an article by Michael Ovitz. And I thought, oh my God, Michael Ovitz, where have you been? And then I realized, wait a second, this is a book excerpt.
That's right. A new book coming out this week. The one that everyone's going to be reading is, of course, Who is Michael Ovitz? It's his memoir. So he tells his own story. So we'll have to see how that works out. That's certainly a big book of the week, but it's embargoed. I wasn't able to see an advance copy. So my pick as a book that people should option is Ninth Street Women by Mary Gabriel. It's sort of a group biography, which is a trend that's really become popular in recent years. To me, it started with The Metaphysical Club by Louis Menon. I'm sure other people did it before and since then, but that to me is sort of the modern era where people said, hey, what a great way to cover a bunch of different people. It's a group bio of the women who broke into the all-male enclave of abstract art in the 50s and 60s. They were housewives or children of privilege or working class, you name it. And their names are even familiar if you know anything about art. Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Grace Hartigan, Joan Mitchell, not Joni Mitchell, but Joan Mitchell, even though Joni Mitchell's a fine painter herself, and Helen Frankenthaler. So it's an exciting group portrait. They did really cool stuff. I mean, the description in the book says, from their cold water lofts where they worked, drank, fought, and loved, these pioneers burst open the door to the art world for themselves and countless others to come. It sounds like a perfect Me Too era story, doesn't it? Witherspoon, calling Reese Witherspoon.
I'm sure she's already read it.
She's in the New York Times Book Review, which is different from the New York Review of Books. She's in that insert that comes with the New York Times. They have her talking about your favorite books, what she's reading now, what's on her nightstand, stuff like that.
Let me ask you what you're reading now for a second. Have you read this book, Cherry, by Nico Walker?
Cherry or Cherry?
Cherry.
Cherry, C-H-E-R-R-Y.
Correct.
All right. Yeah, I know that book, but I have not read it. No.
Okay.
I am reading Winter War, which is a history book about the time period from Franklin Delano Roosevelt winning the election to taking office, when he and Hoover basically battled. Hoover was determined to do anything he could to stop FDR from actually enacting the New Deal, even though FDR won the election. And Hoover kind of set the template for the next 60, 70 years of making the right conservative party be incredibly anti-social safety net, which it was not at the time. He thought this was going to destroy America, ruin everything, and he just did everything he could in the 4 months from the election to giving up office to block FDR and try and trick him or trap him with this, that, and thing. So it was the ideological battle over how to help the country in times of need and what would become the DNA of each modern party. The Republican and Democratic parties were really formed in those 4 months during the Winter War. It's a really good book. I'm enjoying it a lot.
I see a movie in the future.
Not for that one. That's not a very movie friendly project. I really do try and come up with stuff that will work as a film. There's certainly going to be a lot of Me Too movies, and I think Ninth Street Women will work. And I made the distinction about the New York Times Book Review because we've got a story about the New York Review of Books, which is a separate publication.
That's right. And that moves us along into our sexual misconduct news. And Ian,
that's right.
Ian,
That's your phrase of the week. That's right.
Oh, really?
Sorry, I'm having so much fun because you can't edit, so I know I can say and do whatever I want.
That's right, because I'm locked into my time.
That's right.
Very good. You're right. You're right. You see, I managed to get around it. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, going on.
Yeah, moving on to sexual misconduct news, a segment that I cannot wait to say there's no need for it anymore. Ian Baruma of the New York Review of Books is out. He was the editor of the New York Review of Books. And I guess, Michael, you say it's one of the worst gender disparities of any arts journal out there.
Well, there were looks at different publications and who are they publishing? Who has bylines? And they were looking at sort of art publications and things like the New York Review of Books and saying, what's the male and female breakdown? Not that there isn't more genders than male, female. There's also, of course, anyway. So they did that. And when you looked at these groups and they listed these magazines and said, how are they doing? How many books are reviewed by the New York Times? Who's getting a byline in the New York Times Book Review? They look at it all sorts of ways. The New York Review of Books had one of the worst gender disparities. All male and all males talking about males. Women were barely visible. So they really had a problem in terms of women having a voice at the publication and covering female writers who have been around for quite a while. So that was already a problem. Male contributors have long outnumbered female contributors. And Ian Baruma bumped into this guy from Canada who was a big Canadian radio broadcaster, Gian Gomeshi, who was embroiled in the Me Too era. And he said, that's interesting. An essay from this guy talking about what it was like when you sort of faced the public pillorying of the media and the world and trial by media rather than trial by jury, because this guy, as he knew it, was, went to trial and he was acquitted of sexual assault charges in 2016. So sure, write me an essay. And they had a big staff meeting, a debate, people weighed in. All the younger people were basically saying, this is ridiculous. And all the older men were going, that's fine. What are you talking about? We're just hearing his voice. So it blew up in their face badly. Ian Buruma is out at the New York Review of Books. The piece itself was self-pitying and inaccurate. For example, Gian Gomeshi described, you know, that he'd had some accusations of misconduct, and several women stepped forward after the initial one. Well, no. 20 women stepped forward. So that's a hell of a lot more than some. So basically, opening up your platform to give a guy a chance to say, oh, I've suffered so much, and to downplay and minimize the actual number of people who were accusing him of things like punching them in the head. Punching them in the head.
I don't mean to laugh, but it's like,
I don't mean exactly.
How do you do that?
He said, nice bum. You know, no, I like your dress. No. Punching women in the head that, you know, he was in relationships. I mean, you know, nightmare stuff. And Ian Buruma, very defensive. He's like, well, who am I to judge? I don't know. He was acquitted. You know, how am I supposed to know? Proving, of course, that he's an old, straight, white male. So, you know, he is probably completely confused as to why he is out of a job. He has no idea what's going on. But everybody under 50 is going, you're an idiot. But anyway, Buruma is out of a job. He has no idea why, but we do. It's okay to readdress things. Or, you know, if you found someone who was, you know, faced, you know, like the guys at the, what was the college student rape case where you had a lone sex worker accusing them of rape, and even the person with her said she was lying, but nonetheless it became a huge imbroglio and those guys suffered. You know, these things do happen once in a blue moon, and it's worth keeping that in mind and talking to people and getting a different perspective. But, you know, you've got a guy who's got 20 women coming forward saying horrible things, and you give him a chance to say, oh, I've suffered so much, and minimize what you know, other people said about him. That's really not a smart idea.
Well, thankfully, this week, that wraps up our sexual misconduct news and moves us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, just days after the West End made history by allowing two actors to share a role on a permanent basis, the Equity Union is urging new terms to make conditions for cast and crew more positive and family-friendly. Among the goals they've announced are a 6% raise on minimum rates, banning rehearsals on Sunday so everyone has at least one day off a week, and limiting rehearsals early on to Monday through Friday. Official clauses to support job shares and flexible working, better conditions for actors who cover an understudy, and a weekly travel fee of £32 for those who live at least 25 miles from Charing Cross Station in central London, which, you know, given the price of housing in London near Charing Cross Station, is pretty much everyone. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. There's a lot of good things in here, and they seem very reasonable, and they seem some things that should have happened a long time ago. I'm not sure about your geography. I don't think you realize quite how far 25 miles is. You can be well outside central London and not be 25 miles away. So it doesn't cover as many people as you might think.
Well, but here's the thing. I'm hoping that, you know, I know that, but I'm hoping that not everybody is up on their geography and that joke still works because people think London is expensive, which is
London
pretty
is
much
extreme.
The joke.
London is extremely expensive, but you can go way out into Queens and be, you know, 40 minutes away from Manhattan, but you're still not 25 miles away. That's a long distance. But anyway.
No, in fact, actually, JFK Airport is 12 miles away from Rockefeller Center in Manhattan.
Oh, and what about LaGuardia?
Well, that's even closer. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that's the one that's way far away.
Yes.
Good point.
This is very sad news that I'm about to say here. Los Angeles is losing an icon in radio. DJ Gary Calamar is leaving KCRW after 25 years on the air. He's even more well-known in the entertainment business as a music supervisor, lending his taste and talent to projects like 6 Feet Under, True Blood, Dexter, and House. Using a song by Sia in the climax of 6 Feet Under led to her getting a record deal, in fact. Calamar isn't going to be gone for long. He's exploring options like terrestrial and satellite radio. Big deal or big whoop?
I'll pass it back to you.
Well, KCRW is a taste-making radio station. It is one of the stations that, you know, is the first or one of the first to play lots of different music, like KEXP out of Seattle. So, you know, Gary Calamar was one of the DJs that helped make them a taste-making radio station over the last 30 years. Jason Bentley, Chris DeRedis are also, you know, Garth Trinidad,
And these are actual DJs who get to pick the music that they're playing, which is a fading art in terms of radio.
Oh, absolutely. Nick Harcourt, I don't know if I mentioned him. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what happened here. I don't know whether he's just stepping down and moving on.
I think he's just moving on. He's ready for some new challenges, I think. That seems to be all that it is.
You know, I used to see him all the time at media screenings, and we would always talk about what song he'd picked for, at the time, I think it was Las Vegas he was working on. But he's a very well-known music supervisor who helps kind of try and explain music supervision to others, to on radio and on television shows. He's always like the person you turn to if you need a quote about music supervision. He's a very nice guy. And so I look forward to continuing to listen to him wherever he may land.
Yeah, you know, KCRW is one of those names before the era of the internet. It was just a name you would read in Billboard or somewhere else and know that was a great radio station. If you were in that part of the country, you would eagerly dial it in while you were there. It's sort of the thing you would even record it on cassette so you could go back home and keep listening to the stuff you were hearing. That's how cool they were. Nowadays, of course, you can listen to any station around the world practically, but it's still a name that really hits you and go, wow, that's a great radio station.
American Idol winner Kelly Clarkson is getting her own daytime talk show. I could have called her the judge on NBC's The Voice, where Clarkson's infectious banter and positive spirit clearly caught the eye of producers looking for the next Ellen. But even after years on The Voice, one still thinks of Clarkson as the winner of American Idol. A pilot was filmed, and now it's already been cleared for 30% of the country as a lead-in to Ellen DeGeneres' talk show. Clarkson's venture is described as a weekday brunch party filled with guests who might never meet one another. Bloody Marys are optional. Although, given the Me Too movement, I might say, hey, make them virgin Bloody Marys, but that's another story. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, of course. Pop singer gets talk show, as our friend Karen Woodward would have said once upon a time. But still, it's amazing the talent that came out of American Idol and still may come. You don't hear about any of the people on The Voice or even really America's Got Talent. A few of them have done some things, but really Idol towers over them in terms of actually finding people who have had actual careers. So it's just one more example of that.
Now, this next story, actually, could be, you know, it could have
been a feature. This could be an inside baseball. It could be, yeah, exactly. This is so enraging.
The United States has terrible internet. Okay, we've talked about it before. It is among the slowest and the most expensive in the world among major countries. Blame the monopolies that too many telcos and wireless carriers enjoy. One of the few areas where wireless carriers don't have free rein are the deals they must strike on the state and local level. So now, the Republican-controlled FCC has just undercut that authority. They passed new rules that amount to a $2 billion giveaway to wireless carriers. It means cities are hamstrung and cannot make in-kind demands or charge reasonable fees during the launch of 5G cell towers and the like. Cities and states are outraged, of course, but the FCC is holding pat. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. Hopefully this won't be the last we hear about it. In essence, cities will be forced to place those cells on poles and traffic lights and other government property and blocks that cities own. And they won't allow those cities to insist that the company do things in kind, like provide cells in areas where they normally wouldn't be bothered. In other words, they say, all right, you want your cell towers in our downtown center or big suburban areas where there's a lot of density of people, you got to put some out in the hinterlands and over here and over there. Guess what? Without them being able to insist for that, that's not going to happen. That means rural areas, the heartland, poor areas, poor neighborhoods, they will not bother, which means 5G, which is already slow and not getting, you know, spread out in the U.S. in terms of fiber and stuff, will be even less likely to reach all Americans. This is what happened with electricity and water. If the government didn't step in, it never would have been electrified farmland. It never would have electrified poor neighborhoods because big companies can't be bothered. There's not enough money to be made. You have to have the government there to say you need to service those areas. And that's why having the federal government step in and do the opposite of what they once did is so annoying.
Well, you know, I wish we had the time to go into this further because it is, you know, I understand that from the carrier's perspective, it can be a pain in the neck to deal with certain towns. Absolutely. I live in a town that has made it impossible for some of these cell carriers to put up towers. And frankly, the carriers have given up and cell service has declined to a point where the residents are up in arms with the city council over the fact that it's become so difficult for these carriers to get in and the carriers have given up. That said,
None of them should have monopolies. If we had the government-owned pipes and let the people compete to gain sign up customers for that last step, then we'd be in a whole different world where actual competition was involved. They'd provide better service, and there'd be an incentive to provide better towers. When you've got a monopoly, there's no incentive to provide good service. That's the ultimate problem.
Well, here's the thing. There is no monopoly in the United States for wireless carriers. I'm only talking about wireless here. And why am I only talking about wireless? Because of 5G. 5G has the potential to basically leapfrog over cable internet.
Meaning, I thought there was no standard yet. So how can we
talk
about it?
There is a standard now. There was a standard as of the middle of last year. And the first chips, okay, are now available. And Verizon is one of the first to actually offer it. They're offering it in four different cities. And this technology in the U.S. will begin to, and really the world, will begin to propagate pretty quickly because it has the chance to be faster than cable internet.
And so, well, you mean cable internet in the U.S. or cable internet all over the world?
All over the world. So,
is it equal to fiber, or what's its speed equivalent?
I'd have to go back and look.
Okay.
But basically,
here's a big leap ahead.
Okay. Yeah, it's a big leap ahead. And here's long story short: wireline, i.e., cable internet, those have local monopolies. You know, so if you're Comcast, you know.
Or for your TV service, stuff
yes,
like that.
They can't, you know, Comcast will get San Francisco. Comcast will get Philadelphia. Nobody else can come in and install cable. You can get DirecTV.
Right, but cell phones, there's more competition.
Correct. So all of a sudden, net neutrality takes a little bit of a turn because, sure, you know what? Comcast, you're going to throttle me. I'm just going to drop wireline service. I'm just going to go straight to 5G.
Well, but that can't work for TV, surely.
It can work for internet. Internet is what we're talking about here.
Well, we're talking about everything.
Right.
There's a monopoly on cable on things going into your home. There's a monopoly. That's bad. Now you're talking about cell phone service, and there's less of a monopoly, but it's still not good to have the federal government blocking local, you know, to make it harder. Companies still will have less incentive to put up cell towers in poor neighborhoods and rural areas. Why? They don't want to bother. They didn't bother with electricity. They're not going to bother with 5G unless you're saying they don't need the cell towers and can reach people with satellites, but that's not the case, is
it? No, not at all.
So there is no incentive for them to bother providing service to rural areas, low-density populations, and poor neighborhoods. That's the problem. Yes, I'm awesome excited that 5G is going to be great and be really fast and good, and there will be competition for my iPhone in New York City. I get you that. But for people outside New York City, their service will continue to deteriorate, and they'll be left farther and farther behind. And nothing about 5G is going to change that unless the government forces them to provide coverage in everywhere.
And it, ideally, it's not just your iPhone, but it could be your home internet as well.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, a few weeks ago, we talked about the most produced plays and musicals at high schools around the country. Now we've got info from American Theater Magazine about the most produced plays and playwrights around the country at regional theaters and the like. It covers the 2018-2019 season based on the list sent to them by 387 different organizations, announcing some 2,280 individual productions. Topping the list, Lucas Hanath, who has both the most produced single play, A Doll's House Part 2, and the most productions of all his work, with some 33 mountings of A Doll's House plus Red Speedo and others. But here's the real headline. 8 of the top 11 plays are from women, and 8 of the top 10 playwrights are women as well. Lynn Nottage, Dominique Morisseau, Kate Hamill, and Paula Vogel are just some of the names you'll spot. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. This list does not include Christmas shows like Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol in general, and it doesn't include Shakespeare. But other than that, you're competing with, you know, everybody else in history. So to see all these women on this list is really awesome and exciting. One of the big plays is The Wolves, about a female soccer team, written by Sarah DeLapp. And that has been a really popular play because it provides great roles for a bunch of women, which historically a lot of plays did not have great roles for women. There'd be 8 men and 2 women or no women. So this is a real sea change. And when you see these plays being produced, that means more actors are getting work. That means more kids will see themselves on stage and maybe go into the career. It just has a great domino effect. So really, really exciting to see. And frankly, one of the shows on the list is Skeleton Crew. And you know just as well as I do, Sperling, that right up above it on the list is Lynn Nottage's Sweat, but we both think Skeleton Crew is a much superior play about a very similar topic.
Yes, in fact, when I read the description of Sweat, I went, wait a second, I think I saw that. Oh, wait, no, it was Skeleton Crew that I saw.
Exactly.
Just as NBC was able to boast some key ratings victories, its entertainment head Bob Greenblatt is stepping down. He's been with the network since 2011, and while the triumph in ratings included one-time boosts like the Super Bowl and the Olympics, it's still a win. With the unexpected death of his longtime friend Craig Zaden, Greenblatt wants to reassess and figure out what's next. At the same time, NBC's Andy Lack has, or was, lambasted in a story at the Daily Beast claiming he dropped the ball on sexual misconduct charges and allowed an exec with his own charges of impropriety to deal with the issue affecting another executive. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal in both cases. It's a big deal for Greenblatt to step down. He's the first and only openly gay broadcast TV president. First guy to be gay, openly gay, and in charge of this division in this way. So that's very exciting and cool. Andy Lack, of course, is an entirely different issue. We'll have to see where Greenblatt ends up and what happens to Andy Lack. This is just the first, perhaps, of more stories. It's all part of this era.
Yeah, and now other than, you know, basically ignoring an issue, he's not, Andy Lack is not, you know, accused of doing anything.
Well, he's accused of ignoring sexual misconduct in his workplace and creating a bad environment. Yes, absolutely. That's a bad thing, period. Moving on.
Okay, Grammy-winning singer Sam Smith had a dramatic moment last week. He was about to take the stage for a set at the iHeart Radio Festival and had to suddenly cancel. Why? The singer lost his voice, actually. He then flew to Boston, which Variety pointed out is the city one can find Dr. Steven Zeitels, who has done vocal surgery on singers like Adele, Steven Tyler, and Julie Andrews. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for Sam Smith, obviously, one of the biggest acts in the world right now, so we'll have to see what happens. But I was like, really, Zeitels, the doctor who operated on Julie Andrews? Why would you go to him? But no. This is not the team of doctors that operated on her, and then she subsequently sued and settled for money out of court. No. This is the doctor she went to after that initial surgery went awry. He operated on her 4 times and was able to restore her speaking voice somewhat, but not her singing. So this guy is, you know, I immediately went, huh? But now it makes more sense to me. So Sam Smith, this is a big problem for singers. Adele, Sam Smith, you got to pay attention to this stuff. It's really scary because it's your whole career. So, well, you know, fingers crossed for him.
Well, think about it. Basically, it's like a pitcher that, you know, it's the only way to make money is pitch. You know, eventually your ligaments and your tendons give out, right?
And Tommy John surgery doesn't always work.
Right, correct. Well, here, the only way to make money, we've talked about how streaming isn't doing it. And, well, you just told me that album sales aren't doing very well at all. So the only way to make money is tour. So that's like pitching every day.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
How many times did I say tour there? It's
almost like Tora. It sounded like, you know, the old movie. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, here's a story again that could have been its own story. It's its own, you know, lead or inside baseball. Comcast won the shootout at the OK Corral. Okay, or in this case, whatever office building the British regulatory body overseeing a recent auction of Sky happens to be located in. Comcast faced down Fox in a Saturday duel at high noon for the right to snag Sky TV. Fox bid $32 billion, while Comcast bid $39 billion. Now, both bids are put in front of shareholders, but the suspense is minimal. If you offered someone a pile of cash and the person next to them offered you a much bigger pile of cash, which would you choose? This means Sky will have gone for much more than Fox's initial bid of around $27 billion. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's sort of a big whoop because there's so much more to happen here. This isn't the end game. We'll have to see it gets approved. And then the card trading is going to go on with Disney and Comcast because Disney's going to say, what do you want? Our regional sports networks. And Comcast is going to say, well, what about Hulu? You know, we got 40% of that. I mean, it's just going to be a big game of musical chairs. So the fallout has not finished yet. We'll have to see how it all ends up. But certainly whatever happens, it's going to have repercussions for years to come.
That's true. And I would say it is a big deal because it is Comcast going international. Okay. Basically, Comcast is looking at Netflix. They're looking at Verizon, you know, and T-Mobile and all of these wireless carriers with their 5G and saying, wow, you know what? We need to get bigger and we need to do it in a way where we just can't be beat.
And
one way to do that is to not only do it in the U.S., do it elsewhere. Now, you're right. I agree with you. There's a lot of horse trading to go on here, because if and when Disney gets Fox, they will own a portion of Sky. Comcast will obviously want that portion of Sky, and will have to either pay a premium to Fox for it, or will have to give something to Disney that Disney wants.
Maybe like Hulu.
Yeah, maybe that's interest in Hulu.
That's right. And of course, now that Disney has saved $32 billion by not having Fox buy Sky, they could say, now let's expand into our international podcast section. Let's invest money in that. That's what they'll be saying.
Hold on a second. You're making a note. Call Bob Iger on Monday. Okay.
Good. All right.
Yeah. Okay. It is now time for Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And here's how they affect you, Michael. You're paying way more for those secondary market tickets. In fact, you probably have to buy all those concert tickets, play tickets, sporting tickets, all on the secondary market. Here's why. We all know online fees for concert tickets and events they're outrageous. But some good old-fashioned journalism by Canada's Toronto Star and CBC News, they detail all sorts of shenanigans by Ticketmaster for a recent sale for a Bruno Mars show. How'd they spot all these tricks, you might be asking? Simply by checking for available tickets again and again and again. Among the
I know it's so simple, and yet, you know, nobody bothered to do it. I mean, we've done it where we've been looking for a show like Springsteen or Harry Potter, and I've immediately thought, wow, look, all the cheap seats are sold out right away. Well, maybe they weren't. Maybe they were held back for later because they wanted people to buy the more expensive tickets first. So when we thought, oh, the ones that were bought right away were cheap, and we talked about that on the air because the other tickets were so expensive, well, maybe they just weren't even available yet. So it's really frustrating. So that's one of the things that was happening, wasn't it?
Yes. So cheap seats were displayed as almost entirely sold out. You just kind of mentioned that. Hours later, some more cheap seats would dribble out. Weeks later, hundreds more of the cheap seats were posted.
What is the point of that? That's so frustrating.
Prices changed all the time, and variably, by the way, for the worse. Ticketmaster talks about dynamic pricing, but the claim they go up and down was belied by proof that they only really go up, frankly. Finally, Ticketmaster collects fees for every sale, right? And then collects those fees again by hosting official resale. So they sell it to you, Michael, right? And then you
have to— Or maybe I can't go, and so I have to resell them, and then they get an extra fee.
Right. And by the way, really, they're getting that fee from those people known as scalpers, okay? In fact, they doubled their fees for this one show from $350,000 to about $700,000. And you think
that's
it can't
get worse.
That's
from all the resales. That's from all the resales going on, right?
Right.
Yeah, this is the crazy thing. Then they actually sent people undercover to an event for a ticketing convention where Ticketmaster and other agencies are rubbing elbows with other people in the industry and scalpers, people who are actually professional scalpers, and they have a Ticketmaster exec on record, you know, not on record, but not realizing he was speaking to undercover agents, but pitching them on using their professional resale program called Trade Desk. This is an invite-only platform that Ticketmaster has, and basically, you know, if you want to be on there, you're going to have the really expensive tickets that maybe go to wealthy people or concierges that feed them to their clients and things like that, or big businesses, and guess what? The fees that Ticketmaster charges there are astronomically bigger than what they charge officially on the public website. So they're telling them, oh yeah, you know, just go on there and you know what? You can open all the accounts you want. We really don't care or notice. So you can open up 100 accounts, even though it would be obvious to anyone that these are accounts for scalpers. We'll just ignore that. We won't follow up. Don't worry about it. Of course, Ticketmaster officially said, that's outrageous. We would never have said such a thing. Who was this executive? Where was he? That's horrible.
Yeah, and then the CBC and the Toronto Star said, well, maybe you should look at this video that we have.
Because did they have a video?
Yes, it was all caught on video because the guy was wearing a camera. Because these days, you know, if you have your iPhone in your pocket, it's a camera. It's a video camera. And it's a very clear video camera. And so it was all caught on camera. And it's very embarrassing for Ticketmaster. And forget the embarrassing part of it. I mean, look, Michael, you remember this past summer, I had two extra tickets to Harry Potter, and I just wanted to sell them face value, okay? Right. I didn't want to make any money. I just said, look, I have two extra tickets. They're actually—
So one of the hottest demand shows in town.
And they're right. Really good seats. Now, mind you, okay, it was on a Wednesday. Also, you have to sit through 5.5 hours of a play. I get it. But at the same time, I couldn't sell those tickets for face value, okay? Even though if selling them for face value, I still would have lost money because of all the fees. I couldn't sell them for face value because the tickets in front of my tickets, literally the row and seats directly in front of mine, were being sold for a third of the price directly from Ticketmaster. So my question, and we talked about, you know, the timing of it all and everything like that. So I went to StubHub and put them on StubHub. And then I noticed there are all these hundreds of tickets on StubHub. And they're all at exorbitant prices. And they all seem to go down and up almost automatically. Well, that's exactly what was happening. These are all ticket brokers that are using tools like Trade Desk to manage tickets not only on Ticketmaster, but on Vivid Seats, on Seat Guru, on
and more importantly, it's people like Ticketmaster or the professional scalpers wanting you to think tickets are going for that price so that you will end up buying tickets for more than you want. You maybe say, oh, I can't afford $1,700. All right, I'll buy $600 tickets. You end up buying tickets that you wouldn't have otherwise because the actual tickets that are available are not transparent and clear. So they make you think, oh, there's all these tickets are posted for $1,500. Oh my God, I can't afford that. And so even though you're looking for $200 tickets, you end up paying $400 for a ticket because you think, oh my God, the demand is so great, I'll never be able to get the tickets I want. So they're artificially manipulating the market. They're tricking people. They're confusing people. They're holding back tickets for sale when they're claiming tickets are going on sale. Do they have the right to say, I don't want to release all the cheap tickets right away? I don't know. I think that's a very fair thing for the city or state to step in and go, you know what? You put tickets on sale, you better put the damn tickets on sale. And if you're not going to put them on sale, you better make clear you're holding back all the cheap seats. Because I think that's misleading and confusing customers. And I think it's deceptive. And I think it's wrong and it should end. We know they do all these games. This is just one more nail in the coffin. But will anything change?
I don't think so. I mean, for years, we have been saying Ticketmaster buying Live Nation was a huge mistake, or Live Nation buying Ticketmaster was a huge mistake.
Allowing that to happen.
Yes.
The government allowing it to happen was a huge mistake. Right. Monopoly.
And now they're basically saying, you know, oh, we'll behave ourselves until we get caught. It's just such, I mean, they are obviously abusing their market power here. It's just, yeah. It's maddening, not only because, you know, we've been directly affected by it, but because it was so blatant, because everybody said, hey, if you jump out of the plane without a parachute, you'll probably die. And so here we said, hey, if you let Live Nation buy Ticketmaster, they'll probably abuse their power and they're probably going to try and double dip by not only selling the original ticket and under what conditions weren't, you know, will be completely opaque, but then they'll probably also try to get into the secondary market and they will allow all of these brokers to kind of enter that market and probably start working with them. And guess what? It all happened.
And that's ripping off the actual people who create the shows and the plays and the people who put on the concerts. A lot of people are getting cut out of money they deserve. It's distorting the market. It creates a lot of problems. It's not just, oh, I couldn't buy my Springsteen ticket. It's a business, and it's affecting other people who are investing money in shows and putting on concerts and touring the world, and it's wrong.
Right.
So frustrating.
It is frustrating, but you know what's not frustrating? Is that
the fact that you're jumping on a plane and going to Geneva.
Well, yes, Geneva, Wisconsin. Okay, Lake Geneva.
Okay.
I always feel like I have to clarify that, you know, because
it's. I thought you were going to Switzerland or whatever that is. Sweden, Switzerland. I don't know.
No, it's Switzerland, number one, and it's Lake Geneva in Wisconsin.
Not quite the same. Okay, so London, Oklahoma is not the same as London, England.
Correct. Paris, Texas is a good movie. That said, you know what? You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. You know, anywhere they give podcasts away, you can subscribe to our show, rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do. It helps others find the show. It'll help you know whether next week we have a show. In fact, you know, you won't miss an episode. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's whereintheworldisfanbingbing.com.
Actually, we should actually take out that web. You know, that wouldn't be a bad website to own, you know, if only to help find her. That said, if you can't find any of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry there or any of his coverage there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.